Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Rula is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Rula interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at rula.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Rula, and this is Rula Conversations. I'm in Nice, where Rula has been enjoying a spell of spectacularly inclement weather, along with the World Tour Peloton for the conclusion of Paris-Nice. It's the Monday after the race, and it's going to be no comfort to the riders who just suffered through a week of bucketing rain that the sun is now out in Nice. The air is warming up, the roads have finally dried. I'm here with James Start on the Place Masséna in central Nice. We've had an eye on the race, we've done a few interviews, a bit of exploration around the city. James, you are following in a long tradition of louche American arty types to be drawn to Nice. How does it feel to be back?
Well, louche American arty types and a few American cyclist types as well. But I always love coming to Nice, especially at this time of year for Paris-Nice. It's a kind of annual tradition for me, and even almost something symbolic. We call it the race to the sun, and some years it is. And it always just feels so amazing to finally reach the Mediterranean coast. The sea here is just so amazingly blue, even in, you know, not sunny weather. And there's a sense of joie de vivre on the Promenade des Anglais. We're sitting here now on the Place Masséna, where the Tour de France started in 2020. Guys playing piano outside along the walkway, the tramways going by. It's a lovely space, you know, it's a lovely place for a bike race.
You weren't feeling the joie de vivre yesterday when the rain was tipping down. I'm sure the riders weren't feeling that either. Weather's been terrible, hasn't it?
My only relief was that this year I was not on a motorbike in that rain. I got my share of that at Tour Provence, so I was happy not to be. And actually, we had good weather at the start yesterday and at the finish yesterday. It was just everything in between. Yeah, but it's been a brutal week for weather, and it can often be. I mean, I have some very grueling memories of covering this race and, you know, freezing glacial cold and wind and rain. My heart went out to the riders because they did not have an easy week.
But you're not the only American to have been enjoying this weekend in Nice. Visma Lisa bike rider Matteo Jorgensen, who lives in Nice actually, emerged as the winner of the race. And we're going to mainly talk about the race today on Rula Conversations. But this is Rula, so we'll probably explore a few cultural tangents. Also reflect on the choice of ASO, the tour organisation, to finish the 2024 Tour de France in Nice. First time the race ever finished outside Paris. Just a reminder to listeners to subscribe to Rula magazine, the most beautiful magazine about the most beautiful sport. Listeners of Rula Conversations can get 15% off the regular price by going to rula.cc/subscribe, hitting the subscribe button and entering the code podcast15. So, James, Paris-Nice, let's have a quick recap of the race. Jorgensen won ahead of Remco Evenepoel and Brandon McNulty. It's always a real race of phases, this. They're the flat opening stages in the north of France, plus a TTT. The first two sprint stages were won by Olav Kooi and Arvid Deklein. And then UAE Emirates won the mid-race TTT, which put Brandon McNulty into the race lead. First uphill finish on Montbouilly in Burgundy was taken by Santiago Buitrago ahead of Luke Plapp. Plapp took the race lead, and this was a day when the rest of the favourites stayed fairly close together. One more sprint stage after that, won again by Kooi, and then the real GC action happened over the last 3 days of the race in the Alpine foothills above Nice. Jorgensen made his move on Friday's stage 6 to La Colle-sur-Loup. On that day, Primoz Roglic made a big attack at the foot of a steep climb, about 30k to go. And after Remco Evenepoel chased him down, Jorgensen attacked. McNulty and Matthias Skelmos bridged across. Ooh, our drinks are just arriving here. The three built a lead of almost a minute, while everyone looked to Evenepoel to chase. And the move put McNulty back into the lead, ahead of Jorgensen, while Skelmos won the stage. However, the next day, where bad weather forced a route change, McNulty faltered on the final climb to Lamadon Dutel. While Roglic's teammate Alexander Vlasov soloed to the stage win, McNulty was dropped and Evenepoel and Jorgensen finished together, which meant that McNulty took a lead of only 4 seconds over his compatriot into the final day. And stage 8 was the usual short, intense, hilly route above Nice. Evenepoel attacked on the mid-stage Côte de Paix. Only Jorgensen and Vlasov could follow, and then that was that for McNulty. Evenepoel couldn't drop Jorgensen. Vlasov got distanced, and the final climb of the race, Col des Quatre Chemins. I think they shared out the honours in the traditional way. Stage win for Evenepoel, GC win for Jorgensen, biggest ever win for the American, and in his adopted home city. So, James, how was the race to you? Do you think this was a good edition of Paris-Nice?
It was a tremendous edition. It was a classic edition. It was everything you expect from Paris-Nice. You have the flat, windy stages of the north. You have inclement weather. You got a very telling time trial. This year was a team time trial, which I think did change the dynamics for somebody like Evenepoel. And then the final weekend, which is always just packed with suspense, and it was until the end. I thought it was a classic Paris-Nice, if you will. The big guns, you know, were there. Roglic has obviously begun as he's a winner of this race, and Evenepoel was a favorite to win. I don't think they were totally on top of their game for different reasons, and I think they have other objectives this year, and they're not 100% here. And that opened the doors to some other teams and some other players, like UAE with McNulty and like Visma with Matteo. And, you know, as an American, it was amazing to see these guys, two Americans on the podium, huh? Because McNulty still finished on the podium. But not just because they're on the podium at Paris-Nice, but because I've been following them for several years and they just are really coming into their own, both of them. I think McNulty was a little bit sick. He wasn't 100% himself. I think he was happy to have the lead for so long, but I don't think he was devastated not to win the race because he knew he wasn't quite there. But still, for him to finish on the podium was a great performance. And then for Matteo, it was, just sort of the confirmation of all the promise he's shown the last couple of years when he was with Movistar and now with his new team, Visma. I was really happy for both of them. They're really nice guys, and to see him, you know, really coming to the front and taking control in one of the world's really great bike races, I thought was just tremendous.
We've been chatting about the race over the last couple of days, and we've got a slight difference of opinion, me and you, about the result of the race. You believe that the strongest rider won the race. I think that the strongest rider came second in the race, but the cleverest rider definitely won the race. The rider who best marshalled the circumstances, as well as being pretty strong, won the race. So my angle on this is that I think Evenepoel was on quite decent form. However, as the race favourite, he had to shoulder quite a heavy burden. And when Roglic attacked on stage 6 to La Col sur Loup, Evenepoel was kind of obliged to follow. I mean, what none of us knew and what Evenepoel didn't know is that Roglic wasn't firing on all cylinders this weekend either. But, you know, in that circumstance, you have to chase. Evenepoel did all the work to chase down Roglic, and Jorgensen's attack went off the back of that. And Evenepoel didn't chase immediately. He built a gap. McNulty and Skelmos jumped across, and Evenepoel, again behind, had to do all the chasing. His responsibility as the race favourite, and his responsibility also, if he wants to win the race, he needs to be with the guys who are actually in the process of going ahead. I felt that Jorgensen was, by the end of the race, probably on a similar level to Evenepoel, but Evenepoel made so many more efforts that he effectively blunted his own power and levelled them up. And it was in that break that Jorgensen made to La Col sur Loup where he won it, and I think that was a time gain made on smart tactics rather than brute strength.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I don't know, totally agree. I don't know. I just I got the sense that both of them, even though they're the biggest names and the biggest favorites, were not 100%. Obviously, if they were, Roglic would have made that attack, Remco would have gone with him, and it would have been game over. So they weren't able to do that, neither one or the other. And then he didn't have a lot left in him when there were the counterattacks Remco did, I'm saying. So I just sense that I don't know. I just, my gut feeling is that he wasn't totally on. I mean, he's good. He's always good. He doesn't go into a race bad. But that he wasn't 100%. When I saw him in the final weekend on the climbs, I didn't see a rider that was stronger than Mateo Jorgensen. Mateo had really good snap in his legs. He was spinning really well. Even yesterday, I thought he was turning his legs over maybe a touch better than Remco. Remco was going very hard, and Mateo had no problem following. Remco made more attacks, but he's Remco. He has to. I mean, that's what he's known for doing. And Mateo made the right moves when he had to, rode very smart. I certainly think was as strong as Remco in the final several days. So, you know, he absolutely deserved the win. And also, let's not forget a very important fact here. There is no room for error in a race like Paris-Nice. It always comes down to seconds. How many races have actually come down to less than 5 seconds here? There's no room for error. If you use up your cartridges on one attack or counterattack and you can't respond to the next.
I think Paris-Nice is a race that inevitably finds you out. If you're not sensitive to its demands, you can underestimate how hard a race it is to win, because I think Evenepoel was a bit exposed by Paris-Nice. He made a lot of efforts over the course of the week, and maybe on a smoother race with a more predictable rhythm, he would have been able to keep on top of that. But Paris-Nice just wears you down. The roads are horrible, they're narrow, they're twisty, they're gravelly, the terrain's horrible, there's the cold weather, you know, takes it out of you. And I think that Evenepoel made so many efforts that he was beaten first by Paris-Nice and then Mateo Jorgensen.
I'm not going to argue with that.
But on the other hand, Mateo Jorgensen was in the best form he's ever shown. He was extremely impressive all week. He didn't put a foot wrong. He, even to the point that we spoke to him earlier on today, in fact, and he reinforced something that we'd talked about the other day, that on Lamadon Dutel, he probably could have gone into the race lead. If he'd ridden more assertively and positively that day, he would probably have taken the race lead over. He could have put more time into Brandon McNulty. He actually held back a little bit. He ended up going into the last stage 4 seconds behind McNulty, and it was the best of both worlds because it meant McNulty still had the responsibility of race leadership, yet Jorgensen also knew that he had the beating of him on the climb, so knew that 4 seconds was neither here nor there as the final GC went. So it was actually, you know, very well ridden by Mateo Jorgensen in all aspects. Well, as I said, we spoke to him early on, so let's hear from the man himself about his Paris-Nice win.
It's still setting in a bit, but it's a huge accomplishment. Like, if I think about where I've come from and just, I guess, the expectations that I had for myself when I turned professional, or even when I was a kid in the U.S., yeah, wanting to be a pro, I think achievement like this just seems so, so far out of reach that having done it now is a bit mind-bending, but yeah, it's nice.
It seems to be a race that suits you, that you find interesting, and yeah. You live locally as well.
I think it's the World Tour stage race that is the best for me. I've thought that actually for a while. Even after my first time doing it, I thought it was, it really suited me well, because most years there's only one day with a really big mountain, and I can recover. If it's only one day, I can recover quite well from it. We came to the race with, actually, the priority objective was to win 3 stages with Olav. The 3 sprint stages we were targeting with Olav, and they brought, a pretty specific team for him. They brought both Van Dijk brothers and Edo Afini. All 3 of those guys were basically just for him. And they're also really big engines and, you know, really, really good on the flat and positioning, so they helped me a lot. But we basically went in with that idea, and the first 2 stages were always, with Paris-Nice, it's always like so stressful that you need a, it was actually helpful to have a sprinter and have guys that are motivated to keep him high up, because it also kept me high up, and we stayed positioned and stayed out of the chaos and actually got through. I remember after the first stage, I told someone that it was like the least stressful stage 1 of Paris-Nice I ever had, because I never saw the back of the bunch and was just out of the rough and tumble of it. So that was good. And then I guess, basically the TTT split the race in 2 parts, I think. It was like, once we did the TTT, then it was basically just focused on coming back up the GC after that, because we had a bit of a, I wouldn't say it was a disappointing TTT, but we had not the result we wanted. And the the weather, and just we just went off at the wrong time basically. And I think we did a good performance with the conditions we had, but we lost quite a bit of time. So from that point on, yeah, we had to just work with what we had and try to move back up. And basically, and we didn't really have the team to like split the race like Quickstep did or UAE did. So we had to be a bit more creative and let those teams play it out and then see if we could capitalize.
Mont Bouilly, the steep uphill mid-race, you've basically finished with the other GC guys. What was your perspective on that result?
That was a good kind of marker of where I was at, it's true. I think from the outside, it wasn't great because we let Santi and Plop take time. And yeah, it was just a strange day to let those two guys go. And that's kind of the moment I realized that this race is really not in control by anyone, because we just literally watched two, I wouldn't say they were premier GC favorites, but they were both GC riders. And we just watched them right away, and no team had either the ability or the intention to bring him back. And so I guess that kind of set the tone for the rest. And yeah, that day I finished with Remco and I had a really good feeling, like super comfortable in that whole final climb. And he did take some time in the sprint just because I'm not as explosive, but I felt really good. And so from that day, I think you're right, it gave me a bit more confidence.
La Corsia is where you effectively gained your time. How did you get away? Was it planned?
It was pretty improvised. It's not like before the stage we had this written on our pre-stage thing that I would attack on that climb, but I did discuss it with Mark a lot, our director, and we both agreed that if there's a moment of hesitation, take full advantage. There's no reason not to. And we saw, we basically looked at Plap as an example of, like, you know, I think in this race there's going to be hesitation and there's going to be moments you can take advantage. Roglic went, forced Remco to come back to him, and so they were both a bit maybe annoyed at each other or something. I felt that 100%, and yeah, just took advantage of the moment. And I think this was a really just a good move. I think it was just good timing and had some luck, and yeah, I felt also great. I think as soon as I attacked, I still had gas to open the gap up and hold them off for a while. And then once Brandon and Skelmos came across, then yeah, like you said, it was a perfect situation. We all had something to gain, actually. Skelmos sat on for most of it, but Brandon really pulled strong, and we both just committed fully to GC.
Was there much communication when that escaped?
Yeah, I had some choice words with Skelmos at one point because he just took me off the back a few times and forced me to close the gap to Brandon. And yeah, that's what he said, is that he was super far down on GC and that he wasn't riding for GC. But I didn't believe it for a second. I mean, yeah, they had a worse TTT than we did, but that's not my fault. You know, like, he's still there for GC, and that was the intention at the beginning of the week. So yeah, he took advantage of the situation, and that's fine. I mean, that's bike racing. He knew that Brandon and I would ride full gas, so there'd be no scenario where we sit up and wait for everyone to come back. So he was smart. And I also think, though, that he could have ridden and still beaten Brandon and I in the sprint pretty handedly. But yeah, that's he also might have ended up on the podium of the race if he did that, looking back now, because I think with him pulling through, we could have taken even more time. But yeah, that's life. You got a stage win, and yeah, it's good.
What was your feeling going into La Madonna?
I think a lot of guys saw the weather and were pretty apprehensive the whole day, and they were just trying to survive most of it because it was a filthy day. I mean, we were from the neutral, it was raining and shivering, and yeah, it was just like basically everyone was trying to ride on the front just so they could push a bit and make themselves warmer. Yeah, that day went by though super well, I think, for us. And also the team rallied around me well, and I could feel that the whole team supported me. Let Vlasov take the stage, and then Brandon cracked it a bit at the end, and I was able to take some time back. And I was actually pretty happy after the finish to not be in yellow, because I know what the last day of Paris-Nice is like, and I've watched many guys lose the yellow jersey on the last day. Coming from behind, I think you have a different mindset than when you're in yellow and you're sitting there waiting to get attacked.
So how did you manage the last day?
Last year was actually my first time racing that stage, because in 2021, We did a altered stage with COVID. They didn't want us coming into Nice, so we did a stage on the outskirts. 20, they canceled it, but then 2021, they changed the day. But yeah, I had some confidence from the year before. I think I was the second strongest rider that day behind Pogacar, and I felt like just that's, yeah, the stage just suits me perfectly. It's like not so much climbing. It's good for a big guy, but still hard enough to really make a difference and drop like the big, big guys. And it's all about positioning, and it's a battle the whole day. So it's just a day that I think I really like. And so I was ready to take it on. And I think it went super well. Like, there's nothing actually that I could have really done different. He definitely went into the day trying to win the race. Yeah, I felt that 100%. His attacks on Pay were not half attacks. He was going all in every single time, to the point where, yeah, after a few of them, he couldn't really continue because he had gone so full in. And yeah, this was actually really impressive to watch because, yeah, being 35 seconds down on that last day, you have to be pretty motivated to come back. And so he I think he did a really good job. And yeah, I was just good enough that day to hang on. And especially on Pay, I think he noticed just after his third attack, yeah, once I started riding through, yeah, I was riding through at even a higher pace than he was riding. And so he realized, okay, yeah, I was also trying to win the race there and take, yeah, open the gap to Brandon. So I think maybe he realized that, yeah, we were at a pretty even level, and he wouldn't, yeah, it'd be really difficult to take back 35 seconds. In the end, we're both going to get something out of the day if we rode together. So I think, yeah, he was happy to ride, and I was also happy to ride with him.
So that was Mathieu Jorgensen, Paris-Nice, his biggest ever win. By some distance, he's won the Tour of Oman. He's had good results in both the classics and in stage of the Tour de France, but Paris-Nice is, you know, by far his best result. But it's not looked inevitable that he's got this far, even though he's looked like the best rider this week. He's really had to fight his way to this position. It's taken years of, you know, going over to Europe. He rode with AG2R under 23s and finally got a contract with Movistar. So it looks like he's done it the hard way.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the fascinating things that I learned with as we sat down with him. When I look at everything he went through to get to where he's at, it reminded me more of like that first generation of Americans that came over, not much support at all. And he came over with the AG2R development team, had to learn French kind of on the fly with them. I think they were giving him classes as well, but, you know, he realized to survive, he had to learn French. And he actually, in the press conference last night, I was really impressed with his French. And he said, well, yeah, I mean, I got that from being with AG2R, learning French. And he said, you know, to us, I was no natural talent. You know, when I compare myself to, say, to McNulty or some of these other guys, I was hanging on for dear life. But he just kept persisting and persisting. That's the reason he succeeded. When you're 15, 16, whatever, some guys develop faster than others. I think he was a little on the, you know, a little behind the curve there, so it took him a while. But you know, I was just so impressed with him and what he went through. I think that gave him lessons in life that have really helped him out. And he's really focused on getting the most out of himself as a cyclist and doing the absolute best he can. Last year, he was actually paying for some of his own dietitian, I believe it was, and some of his own altitude camps, just because he wanted to be the best he could be. And he made the choice to come to Visma to be the best he can be. And so he's a survivor, a talented bike rider, but he also knows where he's come from.
And we're going to run that interview in either the next edition of Rudo or the one after that, because it was absolutely fascinating interview, and I'm looking forward to writing that one. So behind Jorgensen, Evenepoel. Okay week for Evenepoel. Maybe a less okay week for Roglic. What do you make of the two pre-race favourites?
It's hard to say, in the sense that, I mean, I think Evenepoel, he lost the race for sure on stage six. Perhaps he said himself, I made a tactical error. But he's Evenepoel. You got Roglic attacking. You got to think fast, and you know, Remco is so good at admitting mistakes. It's not always the forte of a big champion, and he can just say, "Yeah, I screwed up." You know, it's just a bike race. I screwed up. You know, I'll be back the next one. He's going to be back in the next race. He's going to be attacking. He still came away second. Won the last stage. Lots of attacks. Did a lot of homework. Put a lot of good racing in his legs. you know, he didn't win Paris-Nice this time around. You know, whatever. Roglic has already won the race. He clearly came into this season differently, changing teams. You know, you never quite know how much of an effect that has. There are definitely changes. Bora was with him in January at the camp. It was clear that there was a lot of things that he was not accustomed to. He was asking a lot of questions on the team. They're trying to get up to speed with him. He's trying to get up to speed with them. They said already in January, you know, we don't even know when his first race is going to be. Our focus is July. He might not be winning every race he goes into in the springtime like he so often has in the past. So I think that's what we saw here. He was good. He wasn't great. For a guy like Roglic to finish 5th, 6th, 8th, 10th, it doesn't matter. I mean, if he's not winning, it doesn't matter. I think he got cold and he just said, I'm just rotting in. Screw it. You know, I've done my homework here. I've got as much out of this race as I can. The top 10 or not doesn't really matter.
And the rider in third place, Brandon McNulty, another American, led the race on two separate occasions, spent 3 days in the race lead, and looks like he might be good for the win at one point. He's a good climber, he's a good time trialist, he's a very assertive rider, and just fell short. What's your impression of him over the course of the week, and why do you think he wasn't a factor in the very end?
Well, my understanding was he was actually a little sick. So he was surprised or, you know, happy to get the jersey. But I think he came in knowing that keeping it to the very end was going to be tough. He kept it until nearly the end. And I saw him walking away yesterday down the sidewalk with his girlfriend. He had a bunch of the stuffed yellow lions, you know, from me that he'd gotten, some flowers. His partner was carrying a bouquet of flowers. And he was laughing. He was not devastated. I think he knew he got as much as he could out of this race, and he could win the race. But I don't think he was 100%.
And you had some choice words in your capacity as armchair DS for his UAE team's strategy on La Madone du Tell.
Well, I found it a little curious that, you know, they had a strong team. They won the TTT. And you've got his Portuguese teammate Almeida, who could be a Paris-Nice contender, but was not having a good day, fell off the pace fairly, you know, early from, you know, what, in the last 3-5K. And then you have Felix, Gosschartner waiting for him. And you got the race leader up the road, and I don't understand why you wait for the guy who's getting dropped when your race leader is still in contention to win the race. Gosschartner is about the same size, the same bike, in case there's a need for a bike change, whatever. When Brandon did pop, you know, could Felix have helped him cut that gap? Maybe McNulty said at the meeting, look, I'm not 100%. I've had a good run in yellow. I'm happy to have had that. I'll do everything I can, but don't worry about me. I don't know. I don't know what was happening there. But from an armchair perspective, as you said, I was like, why would they hold this guy back when the actual race leader is still in the hunt for the lead? But like I said, I'm doing that from the television screen and not from behind the steering wheel.
And another team and rider I spent quite a bit the week watching was Egan Bernal and Ineos Grenadiers. And it's quite a curious combination, actually. Ineos, they tried to control the race quite a lot. They rode as if they had the race leader or had options on the race lead, which is their right. They have their reasons to do it. Bernal, for his part, is still, you know, he's still on a long, long comeback from horrific injuries and actually looks best I've seen him in some time. I think his 2024 is looking a lot better for him than last year. And he came seventh overall. He was aggressive, he was perky, he looked like he was having fun racing, actually. Conversely, we saw him at his team hotel on the Saturday night. He did look very bushed, and he looked pretty tired at the end of the race. But seventh, not a bad result for the former Tour de France winner. And I caught up with him, actually, on the Promenade des Anglais and had a quick chat to find out what his reaction was to the race. So here's Egan Bernal. So how are you feeling after this Paris-Nice?
No, really good. Now after the shower, much better. I think it was a really hard race, as always in Paris-Nice. But in general, I think I should be happy with my performance. I was feeling good, and every time we start every stage, our plan was to go full gas, try to win some stages and to go all in for the AGC, but you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you you lose, and it is how it is, but at least we tried, and we show we are in a good performance, and as I said before, we should be happy with our performance.
Yeah. What were the important moments in this week for you?
Every day, just be focused every day, and for me the most important was the team, honestly. I think if you see how the race went, you can see how important was the team for me, and how strong they were. Like I guess every team was talking about the our performance, which is something cool. So I think that was the most important.
And the strategy of the team, you seem to make the team work quite a lot, which to control the race.
Well, I think little by little I'm gaining a bit of confidence, and for sure. I mean, I would love to finish the job they were doing, but at the same time the DSS they gave me the confidence, and they were like, if you feel good, we just try, no matter if we win or lose. But anyway, we brought here as a young team, and it was also important for them to learn how to work and how to move and how to do in the biggest races. So I mean, as I said before, our plan was to win stages and to improve in the GC. In the end, we always want something more, but at least I'm pretty sure all the guys are happy with our performance, what we did, and we are really proud of ourselves.
Have you been feeling much better in 2024 than 2023?
For sure. I think it cannot compare, you know. Last year I was just suffering and suffering and suffering, full gas. So this year I'm much better, and I know I can improve a lot from here, and it's something totally different, but it was something I knew. Last year I did a lot of races, not too much recovery between races, but it was all in the plan. I wanted to do big amount of races and big amount of work, and then recover well in the winter. And we were thinking after all this work, it would pay for this year.
Is this making you confident for the future?
Yes, for sure. I'm more confident, but it's not because I was seventh. I mean, seventh is a good result, but I think more than the position is the feeling I had during the week. I'm pretty sure I'm in a good condition, and I hope to improve a lot from here.
That was Egan Bernal. Seventh place in Paris-Nice, James. Where do you think that places him?
You could be very disappointed or very happy. I sense that he was pretty happy overall with the performance. You know, his comeback is still a work in progress, very much. He said, I didn't even know I was going to be at this race, so I don't know where I'm going to be next month. I don't know what my program is. They're really still taking it week by week, I think, with him. I think it was a solid performance. I think he could have maybe top five. I think podium was out of reach in hindsight, but he was racing for the podium, I think, as long as he could. And it's just nice to see him back there racing.
So we're going to have a short break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Rouleur, the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Our latest edition, out now, is Rouleur 125, Cycling Will Change the World. We're celebrating cycling's ability to make the world a much better place in this edition of Rouleur, with a set of features looking at active travel. Cycling is about the closest thing to a silver bullet that policymakers around the world have to improve life. It reduces pollution, makes people healthier, reduces congestion, makes people richer, makes the roads safer, and generally makes our towns and cities better places to live. There are also exclusive interviews with Primoz Roglic and Elisa Longo Borghini. And we also spent a day on the farm with Guillaume Martin, who is not only a World Tour cyclist, but also won a major literary award in France. Rouleur is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture, and Rouleur 125 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to rulo.cc, hit the subscribe button, and enter the code podcast15 to get 15% off our regular subscription price. And now, back to the show. So, James, there's a couple more things to talk about. First of all, Paris-Nice, the race itself. My opinion, and I think it's one you share, actually, that this is the greatest of the one-week stage races in the World Tour calendar. And the reason I love it so much, and the reason I think it is a level above the other races, is that it is different from the other tours. The other week-long stage races are mini versions of the Tour de France or Giro d'Italia or Vuelta. They're 1 week long. They are centred on a region and doing a tour of that region. Paris-Nice, on the other hand, is a journey. Starts in Paris, which is the greatest city in France, and tracks across France through the chilly flat plains of the north, into the Massif Central, down the Rhône Valley, into the final hilly stages around Nice, to the sunshine generally, and to Nice, which itself is a real city apart, and we'll talk about that as well. But I just feel that there's something about this race that, even if on a racing level there are other events which could be more exciting or more compelling on a sporting level, they still don't have the culture, narrative, meaning and impact of Paris-Nice.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I got a little tired of it. I wanted to see what was on the other side. And I did Tirreno a couple years ago, because I've been doing Paris-Nice for 20-odd years. And it made me like Paris-Nice more because of what you just said. Tirreno's a lovely race, but it cuts across a certain part of Italy. It doesn't cut across the whole country. And Paris-Nice does really that. It starts in Paris, and it goes through all these different parts of France down to Nice. And, I mean, you said that these regional races are mini Tour de France in the sense that they're, instead of being a tour of a country, they're the tour of a region. But Paris-Nice is a mini Tour de France in that it actually cuts across France. And you get, as a storyteller, these amazingly different scenarios between the flats, between the really brutal rolling terrain of the Auvergne. You know, I mean, that you always underestimate how hard it is there. It's often very cold, very damp. The roads are always going up and down. There's no flat. And they tend to be these kind of just slow country roads. The macadam isn't very great. And it's just, it wears you down. And then you got to deal with the real climbs of this final weekend. It's spectacular racing. And there's three distinct chapters just from a visual point of view. And that foster different kinds of racing, and then often you have a time trial in there, which is another kind of racing. So it's a very complete race, and it goes across the better part of France. So in its own way, it is a sort of mini Tour de France.
Yeah, it's a physical journey, but a temporal journey, and on a metaphorical level, it's a journey. I did say that it doesn't matter so much whether it's exciting on the sporting level or not, but it's very interesting because it seems to be a race that there's not really a specific rider type who wins it, other than they are very, very good at bike racing.
Yes, you have to be a complete bike racer to win it. That said, a lot of Tour de France winners have won this race. Bradley Wiggins won this race. Geraint Thomas won this race. Primoz Roglic has not won the Tour yet, but he's won this race. Tour de France racers, riders by nature, are complete riders. So it has fostered that. And, you know, a lot of the real classics guys tend to prefer Tirreno because it's more punchy and they consider it to be a bit better of a prep for Milan-San Remo. Whereas this race has always attracted the GC riders because you got the crosswinds, you got the time trial, you got the hills, you know, you got a complete week of racing. I mean, an absolutely complete week of racing. So, yeah, it's not always a Tour de France winner that wins it, but there's a reason why so many Tour winners have won it.
Yeah, I've got a slightly different perspective on that, because I would say that it's also notable for winners who didn't win the Tour de France, who couldn't win the Tour de France. A rider like Sean Kelly won it many times in a row. He was never really a proper factor in the Tour de France. He won Vuelta, but he was a classics rider who could do stage races, but he dominated this race. Bernardino, conversely, one of the greatest Tour de France winners ever, never won this race. I think Paris-Nice is a more varied challenge than the Tour de France, which does attract the pure thoroughbreds.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, Raymond Poulidor won this race. That sort of says what you wanted to say. Laurent Jalabert won it three times. You know, very good rider, but more in the Sean Kelly thing. He also won once the Vuelta a España, not a pure climber. So, yeah, it does open the door to a different kind of rider and some puncher. I don't think puncher is quite the right word, but, you know, not a pure tour rider has more of a chance here.
And no race that has been as wet as this one could ever really be described as beautiful, but this is a beautiful race. And just aesthetically, you talked about the racing challenge of the different phases of the race, but as a photographer, you must have an idea of the visual impact of this race. It's very varied, and each landscape has its own aesthetic quality and beauty.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, as a storyteller, be it visual or be it words, there are so many stories to tell here. And I guess I really fell in love with it as I was on the moto more often. The pictures I got from here are always outstanding. I mean, or the opportunities I have, they're unexpected and often outstanding and special. So, yeah, I really love this race for a lot of reasons.
I love the big skies of the plains of the north. Always love the Massif Central. It's got its own quirky grandeur. The Rhone Valley is beautiful, and I just find the landscape around Nice combined with the colour of the sea and normally the weather, the blue sky, makes this region special. And talking of Nice, James, this is where the Tour de France is finishing this year. It's the first time ever in the long history of the Tour de France that the race has ever finished outside Paris. The race has been finishing on the Champs-Élysées since 1975, and because of the Paris Olympics overlapping this year, they've decided to have a 1 year and 1 year only hiatus, and it's going to finish in Nice. My opinion on this is that I like it when the Tour finishes in Paris. I like the Champs-Élysées finish. I know there's a lot of debate about that, but I think the world's greatest race finishing on the world's greatest street. There is no other street in the world which the Tour de France meets its match on. I think it's a real architectural, cultural and sporting celebration. We can have that debate another day. But the interesting thing is that they chose Nice. I think Nice is the only place in the whole of France you could hold the final stage of the Tour de France where it will have something approaching the impact that it does by finishing Paris. If they went to one of France's other great, big, great, large cities like Lyon, Marseille, Toulouse, any of those, I think it would be another finish in another big city, but a big city that's not as big as Paris and not as illustrious as Paris. Nice, however, is one of France's most idiosyncratic, specific and special cities. The architecture down here is a city apart. It's incredibly visually interesting, and also culturally this place is a real mix of, you know, the rich, the holiday makers, the people from other countries have always flocked to Nice because of its beauty and its warmth, and it has attracted the world. It's a real world city, in my opinion, and I think it's a stroke of genius for the Tour de France organizers to have chosen this place rather than anywhere else.
Well, I agree that Nice is a singular city for the reasons you just said, and I don't know if it's a stroke of genius. I would also say it was the most logical choice, because Nice, no other city has the same rapport with cycling that Nice has, because of races like Paris-Nice, because of the stages the Tour has done. If you look back on the other great cities in France, the first Tour de France, it went to Lyon, it went to Nantes, Bordeaux, I think Toulouse, Marseille, I think. But those cities today don't have that kind of rapport. The only city that would have been Bordeaux, because it was a historic sprint stage, but it would have been out of place. I mean, here we've got a Promenade des Anglais, that we have something that's an equivalent or a parallel in some way, shape, or form to the Champs-Élysées, and it's just such a rich city with such a long tradition of cycling. So it was just, for me, in many ways, a very logical choice, a great choice, a fitting choice, the only choice, and I'm glad they made it. It's going to be a wonderful tour, one we won't forget.
So that's all we've got time for on Rouleur Conversations. Don't forget that you can get 15% off our regular subscription price for the magazine by going to rouleur.cc/subscribe, entering the code podcast15, and by subscribing, you support us doing more of this kind of stuff. You can help with our web stories, and also you can help us to keep making the world's greatest cycling magazine. James, merci beaucoup. À bientôt.
Merci à toi, mon cher.
You have been listening to Rouleur Conversations. Rouleur Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Rouleur Magazine. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Rouleur and on Instagram at Rouleur Magazine, or visit our website at rouleur.cc. This edition of Rouleur Conversations was produced by Joseph Perry of Content is Queen.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.